Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU a scientist?
I felt right.
But I was so and I just happy. Thought, well,
I had figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, I'm Ben Lilly, and welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true stories of how science has affected people's lives. Two really great shows are coming up. We'll be at the Philadelphia Science Festival May 1st and at the New York Hall of Science April 29th. More info at storycollider.org. This week's story is from Jack L. High as part of our show, The Dark Side. The story was recorded in December 2013 at Littlefield in Brooklyn.
Somehow, and I don't quite understand how, I have become a biographer of renegade scientists and physicians. And when I start on a project, one of those projects, this is how it works. I often start looking at papers, manuscripts. And there are manuscripts like the collected papers of the doctor who advocated and developed lobotomy as a treatment for psychiatric illnesses. Or sometimes I look at photographs, studying them for clues into this person's life and insights. Photos like, for instance, images that I've seen taken of autopsies at state mental hospitals. And then I often rely a lot, too, on interviews. People who knew my subject, spouses, friends, enemies, children. And an example of that would be people I've interviewed who went through sterilization procedures in state hospitals. This is fun. I have to admit that. And I have long regarded this as a kind of game, a pursuit, a challenge, a race sometimes, and it has been very invigorating for me to do this kind of work. A few years ago, I was at the beginning of one of these kinds of projects, and it was a project that I had learned a little bit about, just a smidgen about, through some other unrelated research that I had done, and it was about a U.S. Army psychiatrist named Douglas Kelly, who had spent time with the top Nazi leaders being held for trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity at Nuremberg. And Dr. Kelly did spend extensive time with these men. And the other thing that I knew at the time, early on, was that all of this had ended in tragedy for Dr. Kelly and for others. And it was in pursuit of this particular project that one day I traveled from my hometown, Minneapolis, to a town in Northern California, Fairfield, California, to stand on the doorstep of this Dr. Kelly's son. I had earlier written to him, tracked him down. You don't know how many Kellys there are in this country. But I had tracked him down and asked him if he had any of his father's papers or belongings. He said he did. He invited me to come over. And that's how I landed on his doorstep. I was expecting the son to hand me maybe a couple of file folders or a family photo album, something like that. But the son welcomed me in to his house and pointed to a huge pile of boxes on the floor in his living room. And he said, "Here they are, have at it." And he said, "And by the way, there's more in the basement." And I saw this large number of boxes. It eventually turned out that there were about 15 bankers' boxes full of stuff. And I remember getting a feeling of nausea inside. There was so much. I thought it would take me weeks to go through this. And in fact, it took me years to go through it. But the son left me alone and left me in the living room with these boxes. So I picked up the top one and dragged it over near the sofa and started to lift the lid, and then looked around and saw this array of insolently lounging house cats staring at me, about six of them. So I took that in and went back to my box, opened the lid, and I was hit by an invisible cloud of decades-old tobacco smoke that had been spending a lot of time inside these boxes. Once my eyes stopped watering, I took a look at the top item in this box that I had opened up, and it was a large old Kodak envelope labeled X-rays of Hitler's skull. So that got my attention, and I opened it up. And inside there was indeed a set of 8 X-rays showing a skull on top of a spinal column with the outline of a head, a face, and it was Hitler's head and face. And these images were all that were left of the treatment that Adolf Hitler had received in 1944 for a sinus infection. And somehow my Dr. Kelly had gotten a hold of these images while he was in Nuremberg meeting with the likes of Hermann Göring and Rudolf Hess and all the other top leaders on trial. I put the X-rays aside, and the next item that I found underneath was actually a pair of items. First, a photographic portrait of Hermann Göring, who was at one time, for a long time, Hitler's designated successor as Führer. And it showed Göring in full military regalia with storm clouds brewing behind him, looking very fierce. Göring had signed it and had written a dedication to Dr. Kelly on the photo. And then accompanying that photo, there is a vial of pills, which I eventually found out was part of the hoard of a narcotic called pericodine that Göring had brought with him to Nuremberg when he was arrested by the Allied forces. He was addicted to pericodine, and one of the things Dr. Kelly did was help cure him of that addiction. So here I was holding a vial with a 65-year-old drug stash inside. And then finally, underneath that Göring stuff, I found some envelopes, white envelopes sealed with black wax, and written in a shaky hand in German. On those envelopes were names of foodstuffs like sugar and cookies and crackers. And as it turned out, these were samples of food that that Rudolf Hess, Deputy Führer, one of the defendants, had refused to eat while he was in captivity because he believed that his jailers were trying to poison him. So as I went from the X-rays to the photo and the drugs to the poisoned food, my reaction was evolving from, you know, being impressed to being astonished to being amazed, and also feeling things seemed unreal. What was I doing looking at this stuff in somebody's living room? It belonged in an archive or a museum somewhere. It did not belong in a living room with a big picture window in it. And as I looked out, I could see a guy mowing his lawn across the street and kids walking to the nearby park. So I went on and looked through the other boxes, and they included not just these weird artifacts, but also a lot of papers of various kinds. Autobiographies that Dr. Kelly had asked each of the top Nazis to write of themselves in their own hand, some in German, some in English. He had tested all of them using the Rorschach inkblot assessment, so all those tests and scores were in there, lots of other stuff. And as time went on, Well, I first realized that this is stuff that no historian of the Third Reich or scholar of the Nuremberg trials or the Holocaust has ever seen. And then as I continued to look at the materials, I began to tease out a little bit of the story that these papers and artifacts were telling, which was that Dr. Kelly had spent a lot of time examining these men and testing them, and what he had learned was that medically and psychiatrically, they were normal. They did not suffer from psychiatric illnesses, personality disorders, nothing like that. And so you could infer from all that that these Nazi criminals were not monsters, and the crimes they committed came not from some kind of inhumanity, but from their humanity, their essential humanity. What could I do with all this? Well, I began writing, and I began working on the book, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, that eventually developed out of all this material, and this collection of papers and artifacts was the foundation for that book. And as I wrote the book, I saw it dawned on me that there was a similarity between me and Dr. Kelly. Kelly was a psychiatrist. He examined people, interviewed them, tried to learn about them that way. I'm a biographer. I do the same thing. I interview people. I examine people. I poke at them. I circle around them and try and discover what their motivations are, impulses, to diagnose them in a way. And it was striking to me at the time, especially when I remembered that overlying this entire story, the normalcy of the Nazis was a tragedy that happened on top of it, which was that Hermann Göring, just as he was about, the day before he was about to be executed, had committed suicide by swallowing a cyanide capsule that he had kept hidden in his prison cell for months and months. And he had made this very dramatic gesture to the Allies, to the Americans who were holding him, saying, I'm going to leave on my own terms. You're not going to tell me how I'm going to go, and I'm going to thumb my nose at you as I go. So I was working on this book, struggling with this nagging feeling that there was something similar to me and between me and Dr. Kelly and the work that we did. This is probably a good time for me to tell you what that tragedy was that I mentioned earlier that came to Dr. Kelly as a result of his work in Nuremberg and with the Nazi leaders. And it was that he was greatly I would say he was decimated by the realization that these men were normal and that his specialty, his medical specialty, psychiatry, couldn't explain their behavior. And so Dr. Kelly kind of went off the rail, and he switched his career focus from psychiatry to another discipline that he thought might explain things better, criminology. But also in his personal life, he went into kind of a downward spiral. He became a workaholic, an alcoholic. He had a lot of problems expressing his emotions. He got angry very easily, argued a lot with his wife, once fired a pistol at her in anger, missed and hit the floor. And also his children were afraid of him. When he came downstairs to spend time with them, say goodnight with them to them, they didn't know what to expect. They didn't know which dad was going to come down and be with them. So that was the culmination of all this tragedy in Dr. Kelly's life was that on New Year's Day in 1958, he took his own life in the same way that Hermann Göring had, by swallowing cyanide in front of his family, his entire family. So that's how Dr. Kelly's story ended. And part of my job in my book was to try and reconcile how did this happen. But I continued thinking about Kelly's career, my career. Dr. Kelly had looked into the eyes of Hermann Goering and had seen himself in a lot of Goering's behavior and egotism. I looked in Dr. Kelly's eyes and sensed a lot of myself in this urge to understand others, make sense of others, people's lives, diagnose them. But what I learned from Kelly's experience was that this can be a very perilous, dangerous undertaking. And that in his case, he got close in many ways to the Nazi leaders, Goering in particular, and that had changed his trajectory, had pulled him down, had dragged him to a bad place. And I wondered whether this was a possibility for me in my exploration of people who have deviated from the norm in their careers and in some cases, you know, could be called evil. So since then, I have been very careful, and when I write about somebody, I start considering, how is this going to affect me and even my family by extension? So I have, I'm no longer this game-playing, happy-go-lucky snoop that I used to be, and I approach things much more carefully now. Thank you very much.
That was Jack L. High. Jack is the author of The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, as well as The Lobotomist, a maverick medical genius in his tragic quest to rid the world of mental illness. He has contributed articles and essays on science, medicine, and history to The Atlantic, Wired, Scientific American Mind, and many other magazines. Jack teaches nonfiction in the MFA program in creative writing at Augsburg College and lives in Minneapolis. For more science stories, take a look at storycollider.org, where you have archives of the podcast and upcoming events. Also, we depend on listeners like you for our support. If you love this podcast, please consider donating storycollider.org/donate. The Story Collider is produced by me, Brian Wecht, Aaron Barker, and Ari Daniel. The podcast is produced by Rose Eveleth. Additional help from Brooke Williams, Lena Groger, and Justin D'Ambrosio. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to Littlefield for hosting the show and to writers for leading us through the really dark places. Thanks for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.